Big Mama Thornton, Hound Dog, recorded in Los Angeles in 1953 on the Peacock label. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Peacock is just one of the small record companies that recorded great music. Others include Delmark, King, Ace, and of course, Sun. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, small record labels and how they shaped American popular music. Our guests, Rick Kennedy and Randy McNutt, they are the authors of Little Labels, Big Sound, Small Record Companies, and the Rise of American Music. Rick Kennedy is a former journalist, now a media relations manager. He plays jazz piano and is the author of Jelly Roll, Bix, and Hoagie, Jennett Studios, and The Birth of Recorded Jazz. Randy McNutt is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer, a contributing editor for Ohio Magazine, and an independent record producer. He's the author of several books, including We Want a Boogie, an illustrated history of the American rockabilly movement. Big Sound, Little Labels, Big Sound, Small Record Companies, and the Rise of American Music is published by Indiana University Press. Questions about small record companies are welcome this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Rick, Randy, good afternoon. Welcome.
Well, thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thanks for a great read and a lot of fun listening to this music. Maybe what we should do here is, at the outset, talk about the artist in the tune we opened with. Who
Go
wants
ahead, Randy.
To begin? Randy.
Hound Dog. I think. Recorded at Radio Recorders in Los Angeles, late 50s. Production of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, the famed rock and roll writers and producers of later years. A seminal record in its field because later Elvis cut it and turned it into a massive rockabilly hit. And it sort of ushered in the transition from R&B to rock and roll.
Yeah. When did you first hear Big Mama Thornton's version of Hound Dog, Rick?
I first heard it actually, much later as an adult.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we were all weaned on the original Hound Dog, in which Elvis is ragging on a woman. And then, as you begin, in your interest in rock and roll, go back to the earlier music, you begin to find out there was an earlier version. And, of course, in this one, Mama's having a fit with a man.
Right. And it turns out in black slang, hound dog is a man who is looking for a woman to take good care of him.
Yeah, everybody wants a sugar daddy, so we didn't. So I think that's what's interesting with so much of the music is, as we find with these little labels, is that they had done the music initially, and then larger labels would package up artists to do the same songs.
Yeah. Randy, when did you first hear Big Mama Thornton's version of Hound Dog?
Oh, my. It was, I really didn't hear that until probably the 1980s. It was, I just really, I didn't grow up on blues or anything. I mean, I grew up in the 60s on British bands and commercial top 40 music, and I just didn't hear blues.
Yeah.
Even though that early stuff influenced all the records, a lot of the records that I was listening to, the Beatles and Rolling Stones and all that, but it wasn't until I kind of got poking around in old record shops and hearing reissues and things that I came across her.
Yeah. Even though, I haven't heard this version of Hound Dog till last night. But these performers, like Big Mama Thornton and this record label that she was on, influenced the record producers that we grew up with, I grew up with, including Berry Gordy in Motown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Duke Peacock group of companies out of Houston, very successful, operated by Don Roby, who was sort of a little emperor there of the music scene, and he discovered many artists, but had tight control over his operation and scored many hits there right out of Houston.
Yeah. Now, we've mentioned Elvis and Big Mama Thornton. Rick, maybe you'd list some of the other great recording artists who made records with small labels, were discovered by small labels.
Well, I think the one people immediately associate, particularly the generation who grew up in the 60s, is that we all grew up with the Beatles, and Twist and Shout we just assumed was a Beatles song, and Matchbox we thought was a Beatles song, you know, Ringo would sing Matchbox, and Matchbox was written by Carl Perkins, and that was a rockabilly tune, and Twist and Shout was originally an Isley Brother tune, if I'm not correct, Randy.
Yes.
And so, I mean, a lot of the R&B stuff that the Beatles introduced R&B really to a whole generation of Americans, particularly white Americans. Things like I Got a Woman and those type of things that John Lennon did, such great covers of R&B tunes by Larry Williams. You know, Long Tall Sally, of course, you think of Paul McCartney. And that was a Little Richard tune. And of course, the Beatles, you know, had a little woo they used to do at the end of their tunes, which came from Little Richard. Of course, Little Richard spent the rest of his life reminding us of this on a daily basis, that he's everything from the inventor and architecture of rock and roll, which gets a little silly. But there were so many of those tunes in the mid-60s that the Beatles did, and the Rolling Stones were the same way.
Yeah.
And then Eric Clapton, you think of Eric Clapton, he goes way back. I mean, he went back to Crossroads, you know, Crossroads Blues was done by Robert Johnson in 1937. So the rock and rollers have always dipped into the history of R&B and blues and pulled out tunes and then exposed them to the rest of the population.
Yeah. Now, the Beatles recorded on small labels, VJ,
mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until they were available on Capitol that they became a big hit in the U.S.
And the irony there is, of course, Capitol hesitated to put them out in the United States, which was, Capitol at the time was owned by EMI in England, where the Beatles were big hits. And so it became almost absurd that the Beatles couldn't get exposure in the United States, and the parent company is making a fortune with them in England.
Hmm. Were there small labels in Britain?
There are some small labels, but not nearly like you have in the United States.
Yeah.
No, I mean, basically everything in the communications world in England was consolidated around the BBC at that time, and there were not nearly the small labels now.
Yeah. Now, the foreword to your book is written by a man by the name of Al Cooper, and he writes about the passion of the people who were in the business, who created the labels. And he says without them, it'd be a very different world. He says, without Sam Phillips and Sun Records, we might not have had any rock and roll, electric blues, or rockabilly. Is that hyperbole, or is he right?
I'll let you into that. Well, go ahead and answer that one, Randy.
Oh, no, I don't think it's hyperbole at all. Everything just came about at the right time and, you know, at the right moment, the right place. Sam Phillips happened to be in Memphis and loved blues and was in radio and picked up on sound engineering. And he just, I mean, if you listen to some of that early Sun stuff, you'll know what a good engineer he was. And he just brought them in one after another, black and white, and just cut them right there in that little studio at 706 Union Avenue near the downtown. And no, I don't think it's hyperbole.
I think the thing is also is that because of a guy like Sam Phillips, like, as Randy had alluded to, you know, he was supplying master recordings for other labels before he created Sun. And so he had access to all this unique music down in Memphis. You know, there's so much of the great American music was regional in nature. And so the small labels, what they did, they served the purpose of making that music then suddenly available to a broader national audience. And that's been their purpose and continues to be the purpose of small labels today.
Mm. We've got a caller waiting to talk with us on line 4 in Chicago. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
Fine.
Yeah, I'd like to let you guys know that, Don Roby, who was an African-American as well, who invented, who had Duke labeled there. And I heard, I'm 55 years old. So the first time I heard of that record, I grew up on that record, Big Mama Thornton,
right?
You know, Big Maybell and the rest of them. And I think he did irritate me when he made a statement that he thought it was silly, that Little Richard, he claimed that he invented this thing. Well, I think Little Richard has to, you know, he has to do this because I think with writers today who just picked up, you, like you said, the host said that she heard this record for the first time last night.
Yep.
A lot of people think that Elvis Presley did this, and he didn't. He had nothing to do with it. So, I mean, and this is a, something that the African in America delivered to the rest of the world. And I think with writers writing about it, mostly white writers are writing about it, people think that this is something that was created by, you know, by those guys. And I think that that's what kind of irritates me.
Yeah.
You know, about
it. It's an interesting irony because what I find in terms of the racial politics is that most of the rock history of black blues and rhythm and blues is all being written by white writers. You can't get any young black writers interested in that history at all. And that your generation, you're 55 years old and you grew up with that music, but you can't, there's very, very little audience amongst the African-American community with younger writers or listeners for the, that kind of music, that the history of it's being written by the white writers who have the enthusiasm for this type of artist.
You know, I have no problem with that. I think, but when you do or don't, you know, think that when Little Richard says, because I was a singer as well.
Well, what I was saying is that he's claiming he invented it when you can say that Little Richard invented it or any number of African-American rhythm blues singers at that time. You can say Fats Domino was the artist. You can say it was Chuck Berry. You can say it was Larry Williams. You can say it was Howlin' Wolf. I mean, so I was just laughing from that standpoint, is that there's probably 50 other R&B artists who were equally as influential as Little Richard.
I'll accept that. I have then I apologize to you for my.
No, that's fine. No, I'm just saying. But there were just so many, and
yeah,
that's
okay.
With the Beatles.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah,
I mean, there are guys. Just, I mean, and labels that, you know, don't even exist today, as you said. You know, like, you know, B.J. Kent and a whole bunch of labels that even the entertainers themselves owned at that time.
Exactly. But, yeah.
You're right. Don Robey was a not necessarily a dictator, but I mean, Bobby Blue Bland, Lil Junior Parker, Johnny Ace. Those were some real dynamite singers, and that was a very good label.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah. But anyway, I appreciate the book, Dan. I have not read the book. I hope to, you know, try to find it and locate it and apologize.
Well, I think it's great. I think it's fascinating. I love to hear people who grew up on that music. I'm sure Randy would agree with that. So it's pretty neat because you're right. They've become historical things because now they're more like mainline culture, like you're saying. In the 50s, that was unique to the black culture. It's pretty cool.
Right. You're absolutely right. I agree with you on that, that things were regionalized, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. And I got to tell you, boy, I sure would have thought it would have been great if I could have heard Big Mama Thornton and some of these folks when I was growing up. But didn't happen. Didn't happen. The founders of the record companies, what made them tick? What motivated them? What gave them their passion for the music? Some of them really didn't care for the music.
Money.
Mm-hmm.
Money made them tick. Money motivated them, most of them. They guys like Sid Nathan at King Records in Cincinnati, a gruff take charge guy who, I mean, he ran quite a large company at the time, considering it was an independent, smaller label, had, in excess of 100 employees, ran a pressing plant, had publishing companies. And I've talked to a lot of people that knew Sid, and he just, nobody ever said that Sid sat down and listened to this stuff for recreation, but he made these records. But, I mean, he was motivated mainly by money. But he also enjoyed music, but that might have come in number two.
Yeah, well, he didn't particularly. Yeah, he didn't particularly care for James Brown.
Well, that was an interesting relationship that I guess none of us can really know what it was about. But Sid argued with him a lot, and they went back and forth. But there was a respect there that underneath the surface. That James respected what Sid had accomplished, and I know, I'm sure that Sid respected what James was with his immense talent. But, yeah, they had a lot of battles.
Mm. I think it's interesting, too, about the motivation because, like in our book, Randy focuses heavily on the R&B and early rock and roll and rockabilly labels, which actually were able to produce national hits, which you can't do today, have a small label produce a national pop 40 hit. on my side, I focus a lot on the blues and jazz labels, and those guys were strictly motivated by the love of the music, because a guy putting together a small jazz label had no realistic goal that he was going to make any money with it. There was no sense there was ever going to make any great record sales. So some of the jazz small labels were guys who were just aficionados of the music, who would put up their last dollar just to make sure that unknown artists were going to be recorded. In the case of Ross Russell, he was actually convinced that Charlie Parker would be considered some great musician of the century, even though he was completely unknown to the mainstream culture, and created a record label around him.
Hmm.
So I think it depends on the genre.
It depends. Yes, it does. I forgot about that, but it does. And I focused mainly on the more commercial labels.
Now, Randy's folks were the labels actually were able to produce top 40 hits at the time, which is remarkable when you think about it.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about Ray Orbison, Randy, and Fred Foster and Monument Records.
Fred Foster was probably among the top record producers and independent label owners of the era. He created Monument with $1,200 in the late 50s. Almost immediately started having some hits. Found Roy Orbison through another party in Nashville, and Roy had been recording for Sun and other labels, but I think Fred heard something there that he thought he could develop, and somehow this combination of the two, they just clicked in the studio and personally, and Roy just started writing, you know, these great songs, Pretty Woman and so many, and Fred went in the studio and produced them, and it's just today when you look back, Fred really doesn't get as much recognition as I think he should as a producer, but he recorded many of the hits that were on his own label.
Mm. Well, let's listen to Only the Lonely, recorded on Monument in 1960 in Nashville, Tennessee.
Dum, dum, dum. Only the lonely know the way I feel tonight. Only the lonely know this feeling ain't right. And there goes my baby, and there goes my heart. So far apart, but only the lonely know why I cry. Only the lonely
Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely. Monument Records, 1960, recorded in Nashville, Tennessee. Apparently, Roy was a very shy guy.
Yes, he was. He, in fact, some of the session players would comment that he wasn't that demonstrative. But, when he opened his mouth, he did sing like nobody else.
Yeah. What was the golden age for the small labels?
I think... Rick, you want to handle that?
Well, I just think probably... I would say in the area of rock and roll, it's definitely the early 50s to mid-50s.
And for
before,
jazz?
It was, mm-hmm. It was a time before the big labels were able to finally... Were had the courage to fully embrace rock and roll.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's intriguing. One of the things I learned from Randy in doing his research was out of Columbia Records, when you think of all the great artists, Bob Dylan and all these on Columbia... And they were so slow to embrace rock and roll. During the 1950s, they didn't touch it. They stayed with the sweet orchestral arrangement with soloists and that type of thing. So there was a period of time in the 50s when the major labels were pretty hesitant to get involved in rock and roll. and so it was a wonderful time for independence. I think in the I think also in the world of jazz, there were a number of great time labels in the 50s and early 60s, a very exciting time. And also in the 1920s was a wonderful era for early jazz, blues, country western, before they were all wiped out by the Great Depression.
Yeah. Jeanette, one of the earliest small labels?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jeanette was founded in 1917, and there were, had been some others. But at that time in the record industry, Victor Records and Columbia and Edison, Thomas Edison had his own label, basically had controlled about 90% of the record business. And so the tiny record labels were pretty much on the fringe of the industry. But Jeanette was one of the very earliest ones, and like many others, was an offshoot of another industry, like the Star Piano Company in Richmond, Indiana, owned Jeanette Records. Another tiny one was Paramount, which was owned by a furniture store from Wisconsin. So they weren't separate businesses as their own. They were divisions of another manufacturing unit because it was a brand new industry at that time.
Yeah. Now, who were their stars, Jeanette?
Well, Jeanette had the foresight in the early 20s to tap into all the great jazz players on the south side of Chicago who had been ignored up to that point by the major labels. That was King Oliver, who was called the King Oliver Creole Jazz Band with Louis Armstrong on second cornet, the great Jelly Roll Morton, who was a New Orleans Creole, who was probably America's first really great composer, and Bix Beiderbecke, who was the legendary kind of the Fitzgerald tragic, you know, white trumpeter who died young, and we've romanticized his life ever since. But this whole group of great Chicago jazz players, you know, Chicago in the early 20s was the center of the jazz universe, and it had also the U.S.'s largest black population. So all the New Orleans players would migrate up to Chicago to find work. And so Jeanette, being this large piano factory, about 4.5 mile train ride from Chicago, was wise enough to go check out these players and say, geez, no one else is touching them. Maybe we can sell these records to a black audience. And that's what they did.
Yeah. Now, Jeanette is in, or was in, Richmond, Indiana.
Yeah.
Now, this is a tiny town. Even today, it's a medium to small-sized town. It's only maybe 39,000, 40,000 people.
Right.
I wonder what that town was like when these folks were coming through, and, you know, what was that piano factory sounding like? What kind of setup did they have there?
Oh, it's amazing. It's absolutely incredible. Star Piano was down along the Whitewater River in this really secluded area in this glacial gorge, and it was almost like a little private industrial village, and the recording studio was sandwiched between the river and a secondary railroad spur. It was a single one-story shed. It was super hot to keep the wax warm on the records, or keep it soft. And the recordings were often delayed because of the locomotives that would thunder across the ridge of the glacial gorge on the Chesapeake, the CNO railroad line. So it was a very small town. Almost all the employees were German artisans, German immigrants. For these black jazz leaders to come down from Chicago, it was like going to Mars.
I bet.
Absolutely like going to Mars. Yeah, Baby Dodds was the trumpeter with King Oliver, and he said it was his favorite recording session ever because it was just so absolutely off the wall.
Oh. Well, let's hear something from Jeanette. This is Bix Beiderbecke, who's from the Quad Cities, from Moline.
Absolutely, yeah, the Davenport boy.
Yeah, boy, we're doing some good Illinois, Indiana kind of work here this afternoon. This is a performance recorded in 1926, and there's really kind of an interesting story.
Oh, wonderful history on this around this tune.
Tell us about it.
Well, Bix had been playing, touring with a group called the Wolverines, and he got a big gig with this orchestra called Jean Golquette, and they found out real quickly that he couldn't read charts, so he was out of work in early 1926, and Hoagy Carmichael drove him over from Indianapolis to Richmond, and he's going to meet with a bunch of sidemen from the Jean Golquette group, most notably Tommy Dorsey on trombone. And Tommy, of course, had the incentive for the guys to get together because he had 3 quarts of booze he was going to bring down for them. And this being Prohibition was a big deal. And they basically got smashed before and during the session. And so a number of the takes for the recordings were rejected at that session because they were too wasted. And they had this one melody that Bix had that they worked this quick arrangement out for this melody he had, and Tommy Dorsey called it Davenport Blues, and that's what you hear.
Okay, let's hear it. Thank you. Davenport Blues, performed by Bix Beiderbecke. Also on that recording, the band included trombone player Tommy Dorsey, recorded 1926 in Richmond, Indiana. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guests this afternoon are Rick Kennedy and Randy McNutt. They are the authors of Little Labels, Big Sound, Small Record Companies, and the Rise of American Music. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. You can join the conversation this afternoon with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's travel now from a piano factory in Richmond, Indiana, to a record store in Chicago. Tell us about Delmar, later Delmark, and its creator. This is a great story. This is a great chapter in the book.
Yeah, I mean, for anybody who travels to Chicago, I think if you don't go to the Jazz Record Mart on Wabash, you should be punished. This is a wonderful store, one of the largest jazz blues stores in the country, run by Bob Kester, who for the last several decades has also operated his own record label called Delmark. And Bob is a real eccentric character who everyone must meet. He's usually at the store all the time, and he has a number of claims to fame, but what we're going to hear with Junior Wells is one of the very, very first modern blues albums. You know, up until the mid-60s, you could buy blues records on 45s, or you could get compilation LPs of, you know, the early 20s and 30s, Delta Blues shouting type thing. You know, the old 78s that they would compile onto a vinyl disc. But there was nobody making records, long-playing LPs, capturing the sound of contemporary blues music in Chicago. And he put out a record called Hoodoo Man Blues with Junior Wells in 1965, and as they highlight on their jacket today, they say, damn near the first modern blues record ever made, or album. What's cool about it also, it says starring Happy Friendly Chap on guitar, who, of course, is the great Buddy Guy. And at that time, Bob Kester thought that Buddy Guy was under contract with the Chess label, and of course he wasn't. Bob also, on the album cover, has a picture of Junior Wells, and he puts photography by, and he puts somebody's name there. It was Bob's record, but he thought he'd look more professional if he actually put somebody else's name on the photo instead of just saying produced by Bob Kester and photo by Bob Kester. He made up a name for the photographer.
Pretty clever.
Oh, yeah. He said he wanted to make the record look like a big operation.
Yeah. It's just, you know, a shoestring operation.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the music store has always paid the bills for Bob, and he puts the Delmark label. Now, the label is thriving now. It has tons of releases. But in the 60s, it was just he was living hand-to-mouth with the label, but put out a record now that it's still in print after over 30 years, and it sells better now than it did back in 1965.
Wow. Well, let's hear Junior Wells, and this is from the LP Hoodoo Man Blues.
Hoodoo Man Blues, yeah.
Let's snatch it back and hold it.
Snatch it back and hold it. Baby, one more time. I ain't doing too bad, baby. I got you on my mind. Having a done good time. Somebody help me. I can't help myself. Somebody got to help me. Cause I can't help myself. I'm not doing too bad, baby. You know I ain't got no brand new bag.
Snatch It Back and a Hold It, Junior Wells, recorded on Delmark Records, 1965, from the LP Hoodoo Man Blues. Boy, that is so good.
I always tell people if you just want to own one blues record to have around for a barbecue party or something, that Hoodoo Man Blues is the one record to own.
Yeah. Now, what else is in the Delmark catalog that we should seek out?
Well, there was a couple people. He did two or three records with Junior Wells, one called Southside Blues Jam, which is just fantastic also. There was also a guitarist in Chicago in the 60s named Magic Sam, phenomenal guitar player. Sounds very much like Jimi Hendrix, who was around in the mid-60s, and he died tragically in his early 30s of a heart attack. And virtually everything he recorded was on the Delmark label. And again, those are all still in print and very popular with blues aficionados all over the world. Magic Sam is known. I've met people in Europe who know the name like he's a god, and he never got out of the Chicago bars. He played in a few festivals before he died in the late 60s. He also had a guy named Big Joe Williams, who was a country blues singer. And then there was a whole movement of avant-garde black jazz players in the 60s that came out of the Delmark experience. A record called Sound by Roscoe Mitchell and people like that. So a lot of the avant-garde jazz music from Chicago in the late 60s was captured by Delmark.
Yeah.
And then today, of course, I mean, he has all the big names in blues in Chicago today are all in Delmark. So it's a very... It was the only when Randy and I put the book together, we were arguing what to do with Delmark, because all the labels that we had prior to Delmark on the list had gone out of business and crashed and burned, some of them very quickly. But Delmark is the one exception that is thriving today.
Yeah. There's a guy, Bob Kester, who loves music.
He's something.
Let's talk with another caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. This is Jim. Nice to talk to another aficionado. I've got a couple of questions. One, I've acquired a couple of 78 collections, and I'm trying to pinpoint the Ted Lewis Jazz Band. It's a blue label Colombian from my mid-20s, I would say. And then I'd like you to comment, if you would, sir, on what happened to the role of the banjo in the, especially the white foxtrot bands from the late teens and 1920s, and then, of course, the split-offs were the jazz bands, and it was sort of a black-white thing. And since that's my music, and also what's available now as far as the Hawaiian guitar craze from the late 1920s, culminating around 1928, I picked up some Ponaluis and a lot of Hawaiian guys on Brunswick's. Mm-hmm. And they're a lot of fun, and I can't find any of that stuff being reissued on CD. Thanks for your ear.
Okay, Rick.
Do you want me to take that one, Randy?
Yeah,
that sounds like your territory.
Well, Ted Lewis, I mean, he of course was a big, was a good paying dance band in the 40s. People like George Brunies, who was a great trombone player with the New Orleans Rhythm Kings. They joined Ted Lewis. Ted Lewis was, we played in a jazz vein, but it really wasn't intense jazz music. But it was a good paying gig, and as a consequence, he attracted a lot of really good players to the band, because he could. They toured. They always had very good dates in hotels and stuff. So those records are good. And of course, Columbia was a big name. So I mean, that was a big commercial band in the 20s. And he was born and raised very close here in Cincinnati, in Circleville, Ohio. Now on the banjo was very much like the tuba. The tuba was in some of the early jazz bands in the 20s as a rhythm instrument, and just over time. It's interesting, no particular reason, but just bands began to slowly phase it out, and it became known as exclusively an Appalachian instrument, which is really kind of odd, but you're right. It held, I think one of the things that hurt it was that in the days before microphones, there was a real driving sound in the banjo that could keep a band together, and as time went on, you could amplify and mic your instruments. It sort of left less of a purpose, and you're right, it slowly phased out, and those early jazz groups all had banjo players. That was the New Orleans tradition. And your last question about the Hawaiian groups, you're right. It's just there are some things out there on the internet, but they really haven't reissued a lot of the Hawaiian bands. I always think of Harry Owens and his Happy Hawaiians and some of that. That actually continued up until the early 40s, I guess, some of those groups. But that has not exactly been a... There has not been a real retro movement in the world of Hawaiian retro. But I'm going to insult someone by saying that, because someone's going to call in and say, well, there's all kinds of great CDs available on some tiny label. But there has not been some great return to that music.
Yeah. Rick, the book, Little Labels, Big Sound, highlights 10 labels. Do you have any idea how many labels were out there in the heyday?
Randy, why don't you take that one off?
Oh, gosh. I mean, that was one of the problems that we had. What labels do we use to focus on? But literally thousands. I mean, there's so many small labels. And then among the small labels, you can divide them between the haves and the have-nots. I mean, there's just so many. It's impossible to say.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly in the late 50s through the 60s, there's just... a great proliferation of independent labels.
You know, in the 50s, I think in the book you note that developments in sound technology made it easier for people to get into this business. Now, with today's developments in technology, are we seeing a new wave of small independent labels? Will we see a new wave of small independent labels?
Yeah. I think we're seeing the difference is that it's serving a niche audience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like everybody who has a bar band now can put out a CD. And there's all these tiny, tiny, tiny little labels that are selling music on the Internet. But it's still serving a niche audience. The difference between now and, say, some of the labels that Randy focused on in the 50s was that they could actually get a top 40 hit on that label.
Mm-hmm.
Today you'll hear about people like Hughes and Blowfish or whatever that perhaps put early CDs out and then use them to get onto a big label. But the small labels today are just not able to compete and get big-time radio airplay anymore.
Yeah. Are there labels that you're finding exciting out there today, small labels that are serving the niche markets?
Well, I think there's some real excitement in the world. I'll just answer for jazz real quick. There's been a couple that have been around a long time. The one I think of in the jazz world for over 20 years is the one called ECM that comes out of Europe. People like Pat Metheny got started on ECM. Keith Jarrett still puts records on ECM. Just a fabulous little label that's been around for a long time producing. You know, people associate, you know, what they do is they focus very heavily on just the quality of the sound, the engineering, the acoustic instruments. And remember there was a period in the 80s called the New Age Movement. Remember all that, you know, George Winston and all that stuff. And that was because the ECM created a real interest in records that just focused on quality acoustic sound out of Europe. I think of that one. I'm sure Randy's got some of them.
Yeah, Randy, what about rock and rhythm and blues?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
What about rock and rhythm and blues?
Oh, I mean, you know, there are literally thousands of labels for every genre, but one label I really like is Ace out of England. They do a lot of reissues of obscure stuff and popular stuff, but they do a nice job with their graphics and remastering and everything. I really have enjoyed their records a lot. Labels that do more contemporary music, as far as modern, I mean, country to just different kinds of rock. Hightone, I think it's out in California. I mean, there's just so many labels that they're all focusing on a niche a lot of times.
Yeah.
Here in Cincinnati, we have a new label that's been a couple of years called J-Kerr, for example, that focuses on jazz guitar. I mean, how's that for a specialty?
Mm.
And he has a catalog of good jazz guitar players, and he goes to different conventions with these CDs. And yeah, the technology has just made this possible, you know, where there's a proliferation of, you know, this balkanization of the recording industry into all these different facets.
Yeah. Well, let's go back into history and talk about Dial Records. Ross Russell and Bird, saxophonist Charlie Parker.
Great.
Apparently, Parker was a sweetheart, easy to work with, if you could get him there,
mm-hmm.
if you could get him to show up. Ross Russell was a pioneer in terms of recording bebop because it just wasn't popular when he was recording it in the mid to late 40s. First of all, maybe you'd tell us a little bit about Russell.
Well, yeah, Ross Russell had, when he got out of the service out of World War II, he was a real fanatic of 1920s jazz, and so he opened a little music store in Los Angeles with the intention of selling 1920s type of records, old 78s and things like that. But this was just after the war, and the whole big band movement had been broken up, and in New York, and up in Harlem, the black musicians had created this style of music known as bebop. And the leaders of this, you know, Thelonious Monk and Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. And Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker did a tour of the West Coast, so Los Angeles, with the new music, and the tour did not go very well because, you know, people on the West Coast weren't hip to this new sound. But he'd heard them a couple times, and he was particularly taken by Charlie Parker and struck a deal with him and created his own little record label called Dial. In fact, the advance, Charlie Parker's first advance on his first recording was the money in his cash register in the store. And Dial went on for a few years, but he only recorded Charlie Parker for 2 years, around 1946, 47, And Charlie Parker would die in 1955 at the age of 34. And he was a heroin addict and an alcoholic and everything else that goes with that. So that makes it particularly challenging. The tune you have, I think, is Lover Man, if I recall.
Right, right.
This song was done when Charlie Parker was suffering a terrible withdrawal from heroin. And you'll notice that, I mean, he was literally very, very sick. And that within 24 hours, this recording would be put in a state institution for several weeks. And when you listen to this thing, you'll hear the piano, and it's like, when's the saxophone coming in? Because Charlie misses his opening. But once he gets in and he starts playing, it's all soul. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, we'll go out with Lover Man, Dial Records 1946, because we're here at the end of the time we can spend together today. I want to thank the two of you, though, very much for talking with us this afternoon. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, we've enjoyed it. We've had a kick with the book.
Okay, take care. And here's Lover Man, Charlie Parker. Loverman, performed by Charlie Parker, recorded in Hollywood, California in 1946 on the Dial label. Parker was terribly ill when he recorded this tune, and he muffed the opening, but he sure managed a brilliant performance, and this was quite a controversial recording after Ross Russell released it, but it really offers a pretty remarkable look at Charlie Parker and his music. By the way, this afternoon we've been talking about little record labels and big sounds. Our guests this afternoon were Rick Kennedy and Randy McNutt. They are the authors of Little Labels, Big Sound, Small Record Companies, and the Rise of American Music. The publisher, Indiana University Press.